Jesuit missionary, Father Eusebio Kino. It's rare to stand before an item that was copper engraved in Paris in 1705. Some maps are on public display, and others can be seen by appointment. The museum's gift shop sells beautiful works of Majolica pottery and handcrafted wooden and metal birds by renowned artist Charlie Harper. Every April, the museum, located on the campus of Sol Ross State University, also holds its annual Trappings of Texas celebration, featuring parties and dancing, as well as an exhibition of quality Western art and cowboy supplies. In July, don't miss the year's biggest event, the Viva Big Bend Music Festival, a weekend party that includes the nearby towns of Marfa, Marathon, and Fort Davis. There's music everywhere, 60 different shows in four towns that attract 3,000 people, says Director of Tourism Christopher Regia. November's Art Walk is popular too. Downtown visitors can see numerous outdoor murals with images from Alpine's history and folklore, most by famed artist Style Reed. These include one honoring the Texas Rangers. Frank Hammer, the most famous ranger of them all, joined the group in Alpine in 1906. Later, he tracked down and killed notorious outlaws Bonnie and Clyde. The Alpine Visitor Center has walking maps of downtown sites like Big Ben Saddlery, selling authentic cowboy gear since 1905. The Kiowa Gallery, specializing in the best West Texas art. And the 1928 Holland Hotel, designed by architects Trost and Trost. It has 27 Southwest-themed rooms, a grand Spanish colonial lobby, modern dining, and for drinks and conversation, a pretty courtyard with a fountain and red oak trees. Be sure to visit the Ritchie Wine Saloon and Beer Garden, built in 1886 as a cowboy and railroad workers' hotel. One of the town's oldest commercial structures, it has been restored to look and feel like a Western saloon. It's a lively place with events like Nerd Night and music by groups such as the Doodlin' Hogwallops. Try drinks at sunset on the balcony overlooking town. Outdoor fun abounds at 800,000-acre Big Bend National Park, 88 miles from town. It has 5 visitor centers, 100 miles of paved roads, 150 miles of dirt roads, and 200 hiking trails. Anything you can do under the sun and a floppy hat is available here, including floating the Rio Grande River, which borders the park for 118 miles. In town, hike Hancock Hill behind the university campus. In the early 1980s, two students carried a metal desk up the hill and sat there to study. They left a notebook in the desk that future hikers could sign, and the tradition continues. Leave a message for posterity and enjoy a quiet moment. From atop the hill, you have a view that sweeps over the whole valley, says Regia. It's extraordinary. Fun fact, the most photographed mural in town, called Big Brewster, shows the face of Dan Blocker, the lovable giant who played Hoss Cartwright on TV's Bonanza. He graduated from Sol Ross State Teachers College in 1950 and played football there. Written by Leo W. Banks. Leo W. Banks is an award-winning writer based in Tucson. His newest mystery novel is titled Champagne Cowboys. Cowboy Cuisine by Sherry Monahan. It's true that cowboys mainly ate beans, biscuits, and beef along the trail, but after months of the same old grub, they longed for the end of the trail and a decent meal. Kansas cow towns are the best known because of the Chisholm Trail, but Colorado, Missouri, New Mexico, Wyoming, Montana, Texas, and Nebraska had stockyard cities as well. Those towns saw cowboys and thousands of cattle explode into town come summer from the 1860s to the 1900s. When these trail-worn men reached the end of trail towns, a mighty celebration took place. They wanted women, clean clothes, hot baths, stiff drinks, and delicious meals that didn't consist of beans. Since the towns were doing well with cattle money and other business, restaurants and hotels served almost anything. Imagine a cowboy sitting down to supper at the Douglas Avenue House in Wichita, Kansas, and looking at its 1872 menu that offered mock turtle soup, baked ham with champagne sauce, chicken pie, stewed tomatoes, cabbage, and fresh vegetables. Their dessert options included strawberry, peach, or lemon pie, marble cake, silver cake, gold cake, or ice cream. Las Vegas, New Mexico saw its share of cattle and had a large number of ranches. Cowboys visited Mrs. Sampson at the Plaza Hotel, where her Sunday bill of fare included Creole soup, baked Mackinac trout with sauce hollandaise, fricassee of spring chicken au royal, baked hunter-style Yorkshire pie, and oyster patties a la Toulouse. Vegetables included parsnips and cream, string beans and potatoes, and they finished their meal with blackberry pie or lemon ice cream with jelly cake. Omaha, Nebraska served as a stockyard city from the early 1870s to well into the early 1900s. In 1891, Restaurant Francais opened and served decadent French meals. The French owners offered cream of asparagus soup with hors d'oeuvres of sausage, butter, olives, and sardines to start. Entrees included veal with rice and petite peas or filet mignon with Madeira sauce. In between servings, cowboys could order an omelet with rum, toasted bread, or quail on toast. If they had room, they could finish their meal with fruit, Roquefort cheese, mince or apple pie, coffee, fine champagne, Bordeaux wine, or cigars. Denver had stockyards as early as 1865 and remained a sophisticated cattle town for several years as cowboys and ranchers streamed into the city. When the cowboys and their bosses wanted a fine meal, they visited Moon's Oyster Ocean Restaurant, which offered chicken giblet soup, broiled trout, stuffed roast tame duck, giblet patties, and roast beef and mutton. Moon's competitor, Jack Lambert, offered a slightly more upscale menu, and all for 50 cents. That included roast pork with cranberry sauce or corned beef and cabbage served with mashed potatoes, green peas, and green fresh corn. He also served white, graham, and cornbread, and his desserts included pudding, two kinds of pie, fruits, tea, and coffee. You don't have to knock off the trail dirt to enjoy a fancy meal like the cowboys did, but I'm sure the owners and patrons alike would appreciate it if you cleaned up. Step back in time in Fort Worth, Texas, when you dine at the Stockyards Hotel that's been in business since 1904. You can also visit the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, New Mexico, which has been open since 1882. Sherry Monahan kicked off her journey into Old West cuisine, spirits, and places by authoring Taste of Tombstone. Visit sherrymonahan.com to learn more about her books, awards, and TV appearances. From True West, May 2020. Jeff Kidder versus Naco Policia by Bob Bowes Bell. April 3, 1908. Arizona Ranger Jeff Kidder rides into Naco, Arizona to renew his commission. Upon finding out that Captain Harry Wheeler is chasing outlaws in the Chiricahua Mountains, Kidder crosses the border to meet friends. Removing his gun belt, Kidder sticks into his waistband his silver-plated Colt and into his pocket 6 cartridges from his gun belt. Kidder eats supper on the Mexican side, then strolls through the small downtown, visiting several cantinas. Around midnight, he spends time with the soiled dove, Chia. After he dresses and walks to the front door, he notices a silver dollar, which he carried in a vest pocket, is missing. He goes back inside, grabs Chia by the arm, and accuses her of stealing it. Chia strikes Kidder with her fist and starts screaming, "Policia!" Within minutes, two Mexican police officers, Tomas Amador and Dolores Quiaz, arrive on the scene and open fire. Tomas's first shot strikes Kidder in the stomach, just left of his navel. Falling to the floor, Kidder pulls his Colt and gets off several shots, hitting both his assailants. Quiaz was hit in the thigh. Tomas took a bullet to the knee. Kidder stands himself up and staggers out the doorway into the night. He heads toward the U.S. boundary, some 300 yards. Several Mexican citizens fire at him, and Kidder angles off to the fence to the left of the border crossing. Too weak to climb through the fence, Kidder reloads his pistol with his last six cartridges. Led by Chief of Police Victoriano Amador, the brother of an officer who shot Kidder in the cantina, the Mexicans close in on the Arizona Ranger. Kidder nicks the chief in the side, then runs out of bullets as he yells to his attackers that he is all in. Chief Amador and a score of men rush to Kidder, who is sitting against the fence, and begin hitting him with pistol barrels. They drag him to the government court and jail, the juzgado, with bystanders kicking him all the way. After stripping him of all his valuables, they dump him onto the floor of a jail cell. The Arizona Rangers didn't outlive Jeff Kidder by much. Formed in late 1901, the Arizona Rangers was supposedly the territorial version of the Texas Rangers. Across the territory, and sometimes into Mexico, 107 men battled cattle rustlers, horse thieves, and desperados. But unlike the Lone Star Law Crew, the short-lived Arizona outfit lasted roughly 7 years. Politics brought down the Arizona Rangers. A Republican administration created the Rangers, so Democrats made it a priority to kill the agency. Several anti-Ranger bills failed. Yet, in 1909, the Democrats had veto-proof majorities in both houses of the territorial legislature. GOP territorial governor Joseph Henry Kibbe fought hard against the efforts, but the opposition was too strong. He was also pushing for Arizona statehood and trying to save his own appointed job. He failed there, too. By the first week of February 1909, both chambers had voted to abolish the Rangers. Kibbe vetoed the measure on February 15th. But the legislature overrode his action that same day. The Arizona Rangers were disbanded immediately. Ironically, on this same day, Arizona Rangers apprehended horse thief Peter Morris in the Chiricahua Mountains. Ranger John McRedman, who was searching for rustlers in the mountains, didn't hear about the abolishment for 4 days. "It would have been a pretty howdy-do if I had been killed," he said. Beaten and stripped. After being beaten and stripped of his belongings, including his pistol, his badge, his pocket watch, and his Masonic key, Jeff Kidder was left to lie on the floor of the jail cell with no offer of medical attention. Several hours later, word of the fight reached the American side. A Mexican judge in Naco permitted Kidder to be moved to a private home, but he was still under arrest. By dawn on Saturday, a physician from Bisbee, Arizona, crossed the border to aid Kidder. He determined that Kidder's intestines had been perforated and chances for recovery were slim. A reporter for the Bisbee Review interviewed Kidder, who seemed to rally for a brief time. The Kidder Massacre. On June 29, 1867, Second Lieutenant Lyman Kidder, Jeff's uncle, along with an Indian scout and 10 enlisted men, took dispatches from General William Sherman to General George A. Custer, who was camped on the Republican River in Nebraska. The men failed to arrive. Custer's scout, Will Comstock, found their mutilated bodies just north of the banks of Beaver Creek in Sherman County, Kansas. Oglala Lakota leader Pawnee Killer, with a small band of Sioux warriors and Cheyenne dog soldiers, had killed them. Aftermath, odds and ends. Before he died, Jeff Kidder claimed he crossed the border to look for a fugitive. He died at 6:30 Sunday morning, 30 hours after he was shot. When Mexican authorities refused to release Kidder's body, 1,000 American men reportedly gathered to storm the border and bring him back. The authorities relented, and Kidder's remains were taken to the Palace Funeral Parlor in Bisbee, Arizona. East of Tombstone, Ranger Captain Harry Wheeler heard about the killing and made it to Bisbee in time for the funeral, where he said, "Jeff Kidder was one of the best officers who ever stepped foot in this section of the country. He did not know what fear was and was hated by the criminal classes because of his unceasing activity in bringing them to justice." Wheeler believed Kidder had been set up to be killed. A Mexican investigation found some evidence to confirm his suspicion, although nobody was ever charged. On April 8th, members of the Bisbee Elks Lodge escorted Kidder's coffin to the depot. His remains were sent to California for burial. Here's another article from True West, May 2020. North to the Gold Country by Johnny D. Boggs. The 1898 Klondike Gold Rush and the later rush to Nome, Alaska, have long been legendary. Who doesn't remember Johnny Horton, Sam McGee, and White Fang? Why, Jack London's The Call of the Wild remains in print and has been filmed countless times with Clark Gable, Charlton Heston, Rutger Hauer, and others acting alongside a dog named Buck. Hollywood's still at it, with Harrison Ford starring in director Chris Sanders' offering this year from 20th Century Fox. Charles Chaplin's The Gold Rush is better than any of the London adaptations. The discovery of gold in northwestern Canada sent an estimated 100,000 people north from 1896 to 1899, though only some 30,000 made it all the way to the Yukon's Klondike, and 4,000 or so of those actually found pay dirt. You couldn't blame Americans for trying, what with the country mired in depression since the Panic of 1893 and newspapers blasting news of riches. "The tide," Tappan Adney wrote in the Klondike Stampede, 1900, "was too great to turn." But those prospectors had to get to Alaska and the Yukon first, and those escapades are practically as intriguing as the rugged hikes up the Chilkoot Trail. Crooked Jefferson Randolph Soapy Smith's shenanigans in Skagway, Alaska, and harrowing raft rides through the Miles Canyon. The first year of the rush saw 20 to 30,000 wannabe millionaires heading north. A miner intending to go to the Klondike has the alternative of buying on the American side and paying duty, or of paying here, Adney learned in Victoria, British Columbia. North from San Francisco. Some took the Canadian route, but most set out from a U.S. port. All the Pacific coastal ports were locked in an intense struggle for the lion's share of the booty, each city screaming that it was the only possible outfitting port for the Klondike. Pierre Burton wrote in The Klondike Fever, The Life and Death of the Last Great Gold Rush, 1958. The San Franciscan Call reported hopefully on December 13, 1897, when the spring rush to the Klondike starts, the principal exodus will be from this city instead of the more northern ports. Gold, of course, was nothing new to San Francisco, and when the San Francisco Historical Society opened its new museum last year, its inaugural exhibit was Gold Fever, which focuses on earlier California gold strikes. Tony Bennett's City by the Bay is worth exploring for its history. Wells Fargo Museum, the Society of California Pioneers, Golden Gate National Recreation Area, San Francisco Maritime National Historical Park, and clam chowder in a sourdough bowl. Being good health and a good brave heart, Joaquin Miller told potential prospectors in the San Francisco Examiner on March 10, 1898, bring faith and hope and charity. Charity, that you may not quarrel with the frailties of your fellow miners. But first of all is the heart of a lion. After good health and a good heart, bring an even, honest, good temper. Don't try to come here bilious. Newspapers lauded their homes, triumphs, and blasted the competition. Up and down the coast, the arguments reverberated, Burton wrote. Seattle papers published bitter editorials attacking the claims of Tacoma and San Francisco, and the rival cities retorted in kind. Across San Francisco Bay, Oakland, Peralta Hacienda Historical Park, Oakland Museum of California, saw its share of problems attributed to gold fever. J.R. Fowles, the Oakland Tribune, reported February 21, 1898, the crack first baseman and heavyweight batter for the Elmhurst Ball Tossers leaves for Seattle Thursday evening. He will probably go into the Klondike District. Say it isn't so, Joe. But one Oakland resident made a name for himself in the Klondike. Although he spent a lot of time along the waterfront, now Jack London Square, Jack London developed a knack for writing. In July 1897, the 21-year-old took off for the Klondike, where he came away with scurvy and fodder for stories, including To Build a Fire. His ranch home in Glen Ellen is a must. Stop in Sacramento, California State Railroad Museum, Sacramento History Museum, Sutter's Fort, and Leland Stanford Mansion State Historic Parks for a look at California gold history. Then make that long drive north, stopping for more California gold history in French Gulch, west of Redding, to Portland, Oregon, Oregon Historical Society Museum, Oregon History Museum. Back from Nome in 1902, former Portland police captain John L. Sperry noted this about most Klondikers. About 75% don't know gold when they see it, except in the shape of a $20 gold piece. Portland to Seattle. Portland, already boasting a population of roughly 60,000, advertised its virtues for gold seekers with pamphlets, maps, and promotional publications. Calling for fellow entrepreneurs to kick in with advertising dollars to get the gold seekers' business, W.A. Mears warned, "You will have yourself to thank if you see Seattle. Go ahead with a bound and distance this city in wealth and population." Traveling north, you should detour to Mount Rainier National Park, which subbed for the Klondike in the 1928 silent film The Trail of 98. Before reaching another port that vied for Klondike cash. Tacoma, Washington, Tacoma Art Museum, Washington State History Museum, reaped rewards from the gold rush, but Seattle won the Klondike War. In fact, Frank Goodwin developed Seattle's famous public market after he returned from the Klondike with his share of the wealth. Seattle, Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park, Loghouse Museum, Museum of Pop Culture, had railroads and was the closest U.S. port to the gold fields. It had survived an 1889 fire that swept through the commercial district and was the first continental American city to get news of the gold strike when the steamship Portland docked in Seattle on July 17, 1897. Bringing 68 prospectors who had boarded in St. Michael, Alaska. Newspapers might have underplayed the story at first, but Seattle soon became the main jumping-off point. As Burton wrote, in 1899 alone, 1,200 new houses mushroomed up in the city, and the merchants, who before the rush had sold goods worth an annual $300,000, now found that their direct interest in outfitting amounted to $10 million. One visitor heard so much about Seattle from Klondikers that instead of returning home to London, he visited Seattle late in 1897. "I must say," he told the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, "you have a very lively city here." Johnny D. Boggs is the Western Writers of America's 2020 Owen Wister Award recipient for lifetime contributions to Western literature. Our next article from the June 2020 issue of True West magazine is titled "Deadwood, South Dakota" by Leo W. Banks. The discovery of gold in a tree-lined gulch brought Deadwood to life in 1876. The Black Hills boomtown was guaranteed immortality when Wild Bill Hickok, one of the West's great shootists, met his end there at the hand of back shooter Broken Nose Jack McCall. Was Hickok holding aces and eights, the dead man's hand, when the deed was done? We'll quote from the great Western film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. When the legend becomes fact, print the legend. Deadwood's Wild West past thrives during Wild Bill days in June. The event takes over the town with lots of food and dancing to live music by popular country acts. We stop vehicle traffic and put a stage in the middle of Main Street, so our historic buildings become an amphitheater for 2 days, says Amanda Kyle, Deadwood Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau's marketing and sponsorship director. It's great fun. A prospecting club teaches gold panning and how to use a rocker box. On Saturday afternoons, actors from the Deadwood Alive troupe put on the play Trial of Jack McCall on the outdoor stage, the only time the venerable show is free to the public. The performance is great entertainment as it retails what happened the day Hickok was assassinated at Nettle and Mann's No. 10 Saloon. The free weekend party swells the town of 1,200 with 10,000 visitors. An estimated 2 million visit every year, and the number has been rising since the May 2019 release of HBO's Deadwood the Movie. The days of 76 Bash in July kicks off with two narrated parades, one on Friday night and another Saturday morning. The events feature the same horse-drawn stagecoaches, wagons, and carriages that were used in the first celebration in 1924. When those conveyances aren't on the street, visitors can see them at the Days of 76 Museum, where they're part of a 7,000-square-foot exhibit on early transportation in the Black Hills. Also, see displays of 100 long arms and 20 handguns that helped settle the West. Held at the same time, the Day 76 Rodeo attracts cowboys from around the West. It has been named PRCA Rodeo of the Year 18 times. Visit the 1892 Adams House, a Queen Anne-style home described as the grandest house west of the Mississippi. Down the street, stop at Adams Museum to see an impressive collection of Indian artifacts, including war clubs and headdresses, and numerous images and drawings of Hickok, including some of his personal belongings. "We have a steam-powered saddleback locomotive," says Daryl Nelson, exhibits director for Deadwood History. "It's the first locomotive to come to the Black Hills, and people are surprised to see it right here inside our building." A new entry, the Brothel Museum, opens sometime this summer. Outlaw Square opened in the fall of 2019, and Kyle says 14 weeks of summer programming are being planned, including a movie night and concert series. History will dominate Thursdays with speakers and educational programs. See downtown from a stagecoach or on foot. At Broken Boot Gold Mine, walk by candlelight into shafts as a guide describes life underground between 1878 and 1904. The Bullock Hotel is a mainstay. Built in 1894 by legendary lawman Seth Bullock and renovated to recapture its frontier feel. Bullock is said to roam the halls at night, which might explain the occasional knock or whisper. A mile north of Deadwood, visit Tatanka, the story of the bison, featuring 14 bronze sculptures of Indian horseback riders chasing bison. The site, owned by actor Kevin Costner, also has a hands-on interpretive center focusing on the Northern Plains Indians. Fun fact, the Adams Museum displays Potato Creek Johnny's gold nugget. At 7.346 troy ounces, it's the second largest ever found in the Black Hills. Leo W. Banks is an award-winning writer based in Tucson. His newest mystery novel is titled Champagne Cowboys. Our next article is The Plight of the Pocket Pistol by Ken Omorzano. As the shadowy figure entered the darkness of the anteroom, he could hear actor Harry Hawk reciting his soliloquy on the theatrical stage below. The man in black opened the door to the presidential box and found himself standing behind its four unsuspecting occupants. Raising the single-shot pistol to the victim's head, he pulled the trigger at point-blank range. In the ensuing chaos and brimming smoke from the black powder explosion, the perpetrator leapt from the balcony onto the stage, so setting into motion one of the most bold and infamous assassinations in American history. The single-shot culprit, a .44-caliber pocket pistol known as the Derringer, a pistol so small as to be easily concealed alongside the 9-inch dagger John Wilkes Booth used to fight his way out of the box and onto the stage, leaving behind a dying Abraham Lincoln, as well as the iconic pocket pistol that would forever change the course of history. Pocket pistols have a storied history. Primarily used as a concealed deterrent for protection in an age when most firearms of the pistol type were large and bulky, the pocket pistol evolved based on stealth and etched its way into American carnage in a multitude of ways. The most iconic pocket pistol was the Philadelphia Derringer. Invented in 1852 by gunsmith Henry Derringer, this gun was a .41 caliber, muzzle-loading percussion pistol that packed a punch. Derringer never sought to patent his invention, which allowed the growing firearms industry to capitalize on his success. While some manufacturers simply stole his design, others intentionally misspelled the description of the concealable handgun as Derringers, with two R's, to sidestep trademark infringement. Prominent manufacturers like Colt and Remington produced their own Derringer pistols at a range of calibers, with the most successful being Remington's double-barreled Derringer, also known as the Model 95. It featured a two-shot, over-and-under design, and an estimated 150,000 were produced between 1866 and 1935. Although open carry was common practice on the range and in towns into the late 1800s, concealed carry was also popular, and the demand and desire for a capable yet easy-to-hide handgun created a burgeoning market for the creative gunsmiths of the day. Many pocket pistols were simply smaller versions of standard revolvers that folks could carry in their pockets. Excellent examples of these firearms include a variety manufactured by Colt: the 1848 Baby Dragoon, 1849 Colt Pocket, and Wells Fargo Pocket brought big power into a smaller package, as did Colt's 1860 Army Snubnose and the 1862 Police Pocket Pistols. Another popular pocket-sized handgun was Smith & Wesson's 1878 Model 1.5, a favorite of gamblers, detectives, and ladies of the evening. This five-shot revolver was the first small-bore Smith & Wesson to use the star-type cylinder ejector, and its rebounding hammer design all but guaranteed safe carrying when the cylinder was fully loaded. Like the Smith & Wesson's Model 1.5, Remington's 1863 pocket revolver was a cap-and-ball beauty with no trigger guard and a sleek profile and a reputation of keeping card players and other gambling types honest. Then there was the pepper box. With a history that dates back to the 1500s, the pepper box made its resurgence in the late 1800s, becoming a favorite concealed carry gun of lawmen, gamblers, and those in need of a reliable backup. Although easily concealed with multiple shots at the ready, the pepper box did have its drawbacks, including the fact that it wasn't very accurate. Mark Twain once said, "The safest place to be when facing a pepper box wielding antagonist was standing directly in front of him." Perhaps some of these unusual pocket pistols ever made were the Chicago Protector Palm pistols. The design of these pistols was based on one patented by Jacques E. Turbeau of Paris. Turbeau described his pistol as a revolver which may be held in the hand with no part exposed except the barrel. The protector was the size of a pocket watch and was engaged and fired by squeezing it with your hand. Today you can get your hands on replicas of most of these iconic pocket pistols from modern-day manufacturers Cimarron Firearms, Taylors & Company, EMF Company, Bond Arms, Ruger, and Colt, as exhibited on these pages. Pick your poison, then relish in the history of these pocket-sized powder kegs that continue to enthrall and entice gun aficionados of the 21st century. We don't have room for all of the Jesse James articles that are included in this edition, so we will move those articles for next week. I'll fill the rest of the time for this week from other articles from True West. This is from the June 2020 edition. One Man Knew by Bob Bowes Bell. According to an excellent book, The Great Influenza by John M. Barry, the deadliest plague in history, 1918 to 1919, started in Haskell County, Kansas, and one man, Dr. Loring Miner, knew firsthand about it because many of his patients were dying, but no one else would listen. He issued a warning, published in Public Health Reports, to alert health officials to this new outbreak, and it is the first reference to the outbreak on public record. And then in March of 1918, the disease disappeared. The schools reopened, and the locals went back to work, and everyone turned their attention to the war in Europe. A young soldier named Dean Nilsen came home to Gene, Kansas, on leave from Camp Funston, which is in the Fort Riley, Kansas Military Reservation. The fort held, on average, 56,000 troops. After his leave, Nilsen returned to Camp Funston, and within a short time, 1,100 men were sick and admitted to the post hospital. Many others didn't show symptoms and were shipped overseas, and that's when the numbers go off the charts, with the lowest estimate of the pandemic's worldwide death toll being at 21 million, and some now estimate the number is at least 50 to 100 million deaths. One Kansas frontier doctor tried to warn everyone, but they weren't listening. Bob Bowes Bell. Another article from True West magazine about Billy the Kid. True West exclusive. Long-lost jailhouse interview with Billy the Kid and illustration uncovered. I have been seriously digging into the Billy the Kid story for the past 3 decades. I have walked where he walked, and I have had the privilege to interview many old-timers and many of the kid scholars, like Fred Nolan, Leon Metz, Nora Hinn, Robert Utley, Bob McCubbin, Mark Lee Gardner, Linda Sanchez, and John Sinclair. These kid historians dug deeper than anyone else and found old newspapers and hidden National Archive reports and filled in many of the missing pieces of the puzzle. And yet somehow, some way, they all missed the newspaper article from January 20th, 1881, Las Vegas Gazette, you are about to read, that James B. Mills, a young Billy scholar from Australia, recently discovered. Mills says, almost 140 years after his death, Billy the Kid is still a wanted man. He is constantly being pursued. It is not Pat Garrett and a posse that are chasing after him. It is historians like myself. We relentlessly track every hint of his movements and activities. We don't wish to clasp shackles on him. He knew only too well how to slip out of those. We merely wish to understand him better, to get closer to the reality of just who this boy was. And he was a boy, as we sometimes tend to forget. How did the intrepid Australian researcher find the lost interview of Billy the Kid? According to Mills, while browsing through online newspaper archives, he was fortunate enough to catch a fresh glimpse of him in the January 20th, 1881 edition of the Las Vegas Gazette. Billy appeared to be in a mostly cheerful mood despite being locked up in a Santa Fe jail at the time, Mills says. He certainly wasn't happy with the fanciful illustration of him wielding an axe, saving the life of his beautiful pistol-wielding senorita in the January 8, 1881 edition of the Illustrated Police News. Nor did Billy seem overly thrilled about his reputation as a cutthroat desperado, further evidence that the kid cared about what people thought of him. With the slamming of a jail cell door, my brief glimpse of Billy the Kid ended, but it was enough to make my jaw drop while it lasted. Almost 140 years after he was laid to rest, Billy Bonney had spoken to us once again, though I doubt it will be enough for us to end our relentless pursuit. In addition, our editor, Stuart Rosebrook, seeking supportive material for Mills' discovery, found an illustration of Billy and untapped stories on the boy bandit in the Library of Congress's digitized volumes of the Illustrated Police News that have eluded historians for decades. Hang on to your hat. This is good. Bob Bowes Bell. The Daily Gazette, Las Vegas, New Mexico, Thursday, January 20th, 1881. Interviewing prisoners. Visiting the kid and his partners in the Santa Fe jail. What Rudabaugh says. A few days ago, a representative of the Gazette paid a visit to Billy Bonney, the kid, Dave Rudabaugh, and Billy Wilson in the Santa Fe jail. They were all heavily shackled and were lying about on their cots, but rose as the heavy iron door swung back on its hinges. After speaking with them all, the Gazette man made some remarks on the tidiness of their cell. Oh, this is a palace compared with that place they put fellows in Vegas, said Billy. We've been scrubbing up today, he continued, glancing around and contemplating their work. The men all appeared to be in good humor, and the talk passing from one topic to another, the kid said, I'm getting up a terrible reputation. Allusion, that is how it's spelled, being made to the horrible picture of him in the Police News that has been the laughing stock of the town. Billy made all manner of fun of it. I got hold of the paper first when it was brought in, he said, but I was ashamed to let the other fellows see it. Wasn't it savage, though? He inquired. We gave our unbiased opinion that we thought it was, and were not a little amused at the way the subject of the front piece of the super sensational paper ran on about it. I never had any beautiful Mexican girl with me. It was as much as I could do to take care of myself, was his disposition of the picture. But, his eyes flashing as he spoke, she was game, though. See the way she stood off the crowd after me? Said the admirer of personal courage. I say, boss, sang out a fellow lying near the stove, hain't you got any influence with the U.S. government to get it to give a man a hat? Said the fellow, swung over his head a paper cap, such as dull scholars in backwoods towns down east wear as a symbol of dullness. Have you got any other hat? No, nor I hain't had any for 16 months, ever since I was put in here. He's had hard luck, that fellow has, said one of the boys. He's been in here for 16 months waiting trial for something that his nibs did, pointing to Dave Rudabaugh, who was lying near the fellow with the paper cap. Yes, they've kept him in for what I did, attested Rudabaugh. We were considerably interested in knowing who this long-time incarcerated man might be, and found on inquiry that it was B.S. Jack, well-known in Vegas, and who was accused of robbing the coach near this city. None of the other men they've got in jail had anything to do with robbing the stage or the train, said Rudabaugh. I'm in for it now, and might as well tell the truth. The Stokes boys are perfectly innocent, and so are all the men who were mistreated of being mixed up in both affairs. I don't propose to tell who did to either, but they haven't got any of the men but me. There was a general conversation concerning the Stokes boys, and all the boys said it was a shame that they were ever arrested. B.S. Jack told his story. He said that he was broke and was just tied up with rheumatism. I couldn't have walked as far as where the coach was robbed and back to my room again, he said. That's the way with some of us poor devils who haven't a friend, said he. They just pounce down on us because they think no one would believe a word we say. He was in a good humor like the rest, but he has had nearly a year and a half to brood over his misfortune and was at times somewhat sour. They've got another innocent man in jail in Vegas, said Rudabaugh. When asked who that might be, he said, Webb, he ain't any more guilty of killing Kellner than you are. The imported editor came to the conclusion that his residence in Vegas in March were made a test of Webb's innocence, and that man was safe. I saw the whole affair, and if my word is worth anything, I say that that man didn't do the killing. He stoutly adhered to this and said that if he only had the chance to testify, he would say so. Well, Billy, what do you think of your notoriety? We asked of the kid. I don't see any money in it. Everything that has been done in that country is laid to me, and he really seemed ashamed of the reputation that he had gained. If you got out, you could get up a show like Buffalo Bill. You have had advertising enough. If, was his only comment. The boys expressed themselves as having nothing to complain of regarding their keeping and keepers, and said that Sheriff Martinez and everyone connected with the jail treated them white. As the Gazette man turned to go, B.S. impressed on his mind his need of a hat and a coat, and the doors clanged on the prisoners. Contributor James B. Mills was born in 1983 and lives in the Illawarra region of New South Wales, Australia. Possessing a relentless passion for the history of the American West since childhood, he was bitten by the Billy Bug around age 9 and has remained enthralled ever since. Now a historian and published writer, his passion remains as strong as ever. In this next segment of the article, I'm going to read captions accompanying photographs that are courtesy of the Museum of New Mexico. While the kid was writing his first letters to Wallace at the Palace of the Governors above, the governor was back east promoting his book, Ben-Hur. Wallace returned to Santa Fe on February 10th, but left immediately to look at mining property in Silver City. The latest strikes were big news in the east, and the governor couldn't wait to see them. Billy might just as well have saved ink because his notes were piling up on someone's desk, and his plight was probably one of the last things on Wallace's mind. The next caption. The reporter for the Las Vegas Gazette would have interviewed Billy the Kid and Dave Rudabaugh in the six-cell county jail on Water Street in Santa Fe. Billy's statement to the reporter that we've been scrubbing up today may in fact be an early reference to their efforts to hide the evidence of dirt from a tunnel they had started much earlier than most historians have considered. And this third caption, Tony Nice left and Robert Olinger celebrated their nomination as deputy U.S. Marshals to escort the famous Billy the Kid to his trial in La Mesilla by having their photo made in Santa Fe. The local editors at the New Mexican newspaper dubbed them a heavy team. A month after the jailhouse interview, Nice and Santa Fe Sheriff Romulo Martinez discovered Billy and the boys were digging an escape tunnel and hiding the fill dirt in their bed ticking. All the prisoners were separated, and Billy the Kid was slapped in solitary and shackled to the floor in a cell where even the light of day is denied admittance. What historians are saying about the discovery of the lost Billy the Kid interview? Both giddy and embarrassed at his sudden national celebrity, Billy's likable, carefree nature shines through in this newly discovered interview. From reading it, one would never guess the violence he was capable of, which, of course, was one of the secrets to the kid's survival. For me, the interview brings to mind what Pat Garrett once said about the outlaw. There are many good traits about Billy. He wasn't what you'd call a killer. He never made a gunplay he didn't mean, and he never shot up a town. I've met worse men than Billy. What James B. Mills has unearthed may not change the narrative we have for the kid, but it certainly enriches it. And considering how Billy has been researched to death for decades, that's quite an accomplishment. The info James B. Mills has turned up about Senor Billy in the Santa Fe jail, what he's thinking, and his opinions of several topics is of first-rate value. This information thickens our description of Billy in the last months of his life. We've not known much about him after he reached Santa Fe and before his jail breakout in Lincoln the following April. Valuable new information indeed in this rather obscure segment of the outlaw's life. Richard W. Etulin, author of two upcoming books on the New Mexico outlaw from the University of Oklahoma Press, Thunder in the West, The Life and Legends of Billy the Kid, and Billy the Kid, A Reader's Guide. To find anything new about Billy the Kid is amazing. The Santa Fe jailhouse interview of the kid that Australian historian James B. Mills discovered in the January 20th, 1881 edition of the Las Vegas Gazette had been missed by literally hundreds of Billy researchers over many decades. The illustrated police news images are terrific, too. Additionally, the ending of the lost interview of the kid with the word if. If only one could project what the kid was thinking at that time. Makes one wonder how things would have turned out for him with that pardon he never received. Linda A. Sanchez is a contributing editor to True West magazine and a historian of New Mexico and Apache history. The recent discovery by James B. Mills of an old newspaper interview with Billy the Kid and his jailhouse companions offers some delightful insights into the elusive New Mexico outlaw. The kid's oft-remarked-upon charming sense of humor comes across loud and clear in his savage comment on his cover story in the garish Illustrated Police News. His reply to the reporter's comparison of the boy outlaw to Buffalo Bill displays a certain fatalism, as does the remark that there is no money in it. This episode, as well as the publication of an engraving of the famous tintype before Billy's death, makes it clear that he was indeed receiving some national attention while he was alive. It's also fascinating that General Phil Sheridan is in Las Vegas at this time, no doubt to meet with Hatch about the Victorio campaign that's happening at the same time. Paul Andrew Hutton, Distinguished Professor, University of New Mexico. Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas. Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Music and Memories at 1. Starting this weekend, Recording Library of West Texas presents Saturday Night at the Movies. We'll bring you audio-described films from all genres, from the golden age of Hollywood all the way up to current movies. This week, we'll present Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. A New York City advertising executive goes on the run after being mistaken for a government agent by a group of foreign spies.
Listen to me, I had nothing to do with this.
Call the police.
Wait a minute, don't come any nearer. You get back.
Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, starring Cary Grant.
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening.
Eva Marie Saint.
It's going to be a long night, and I don't particularly like the book I've started. You know what I mean?
And James Mason.
The least I can do is afford you the opportunity of surviving the evening.
Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night at the Movies. Audio-described movies. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 87 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour, an hour-long reading of books hand-selected by staff and read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Country Music by Dayton Duncan, based on a documentary film by Ken Burns, read for you by Brian Corrigan, Dayton Duncan, and Ken Burns. After hearing his first Jimmy Rogers record at the age of 15 in Brownwood, Texas, and committing In the Jailhouse Now to memory, Ernest Tubb's sole ambition had been to follow in the footsteps of his idol, the Blue Yodeler, whose death in 1933 Tubb called one of the saddest days of my life. In 1936 in San Antonio, he met Rogers' widow, who befriended him by persuading RCA Victor to let him record some tribute songs about his hero. Soon enough, Mrs. Rogers took him with her on a tour of small-town movie theaters in South Texas, Carrie Rogers appearing as the living connection to her late husband, Tubb singing and playing the famous $1,500 Martin guitar with the word thanks emblazoned on its back, that Rogers himself had once used. With his memory as my inspiration, Tubb sang to each audience, I'll pick up the torch that he laid down to yodel your blues away. But his days as a Jimmy Rogers imitator ended suddenly in 1939, when a tonsillectomy left Tubb's throat so badly damaged he had to give up yodeling. He started writing his own songs, developed a warmer vocal style, and got work as a traveling musical ambassador for the Western Mattress Company in San Angelo. In 1941, a businessman who owned 150 jukeboxes in Fort Worth gave him important advice. Tubb's records, he said, were popular in honky-tonks during the afternoon, but when the crowds enlarged in the evening and wanted to dance amid all the noise, they switched to the other artists' tunes. They can't hear your records, the man insisted. They're not playing your records. You need to make them louder. At his next recording session, Tubb brought in a musician to play an electrified lead guitar for a song he had written Walking the Floor Over You. The new song became such a hit, as did the ones that followed, that the Grand Ole Opry brought him to Nashville and offered him a place.